Just try. Go ahead. Just try and find a place to live that you can afford. That's safe, that's clean, and in a decent area. You may have better luck teaming up with Indiana Jones to find the Holy Grail. Welcome. We're glad you're part of The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. Before we get to our interviews today about the affordable housing situation, let me say that we'd like to hear from you because this is an issue that impacts all of us. How did you find your place? Is it affordable? And what is affordable nowadays? What about your kids or your parents? Is everyone moving in together? Or have you had it with this area and look, you're going to move to North Carolina. Tell us about it. Our email is tfs@wshu.org. You can give us a tweet on Twitter. We're at FullStoryWSHU, or give us a shout at 833-CALL-TFS. Look, the affordable housing issue is nothing new. If you live around here, you know this has been going on for decades. But some officials are very worried, more so than ever, because the younger generation is voting with their feet and they're taking off for other parts of the country, housing being a big reason why. Let's start our conversation today with Fred Thiel. Fred Thiel is an assemblyman from Sag Harbor. Assemblyman Thiel, thanks for being with us today.
Good afternoon. Good to talk to you.
Same here. One quick question before we get into the specifics of a bill which you're proposing. How would you describe the affordable housing situation on Long Island?
Well, I think for Long Island as a whole, it's a critical situation. If you look simply at the U.S. Census numbers as they are updated, you'll see that Long Island's population is stable or actually growing slightly. But when you dig into the numbers, and particularly you look at those that are between the ages of, say, 25 and 40, you'll see that Long Island is actually losing population there. And so for our young families, those returning from college or who would like to return from college, they're not able to, and housing is a big part of that. So we are seeing, a migration of people away from Long Island, and one of the primary reasons that people give is the lack of affordable housing. They're able to find a job, perhaps, on Long Island, but not affordable housing. And that is that issue is even worse on the East End, where I represent, the South Fork and the five East End towns, because competing for housing, in addition to the usual stresses on housing, is the fact that you've got people looking for a second home because of the seasonal population, and that even drives housing costs on the East End up even further.
So it's horrible for the average person to get a decent job and thinking that you're making a nice wage, and you can't find a place to live.
Well, that is the issue, and I again, the statistics prove that. I mean, and anecdotally, I can tell you that I've got three children. They're 36, 32, and 28. And all grew up on Long Island, and none of them have come back to Long Island.
Oh,
and,
boy.
You know, housing is a big reason for that.
So you have a proposal in terms of the real estate purchases in the town. You want to add, what, 0.5% or so to a regional real estate transfer tax?
Yeah, the five East End towns, the Peconic Bay region, which are the towns of East Hampton, Southampton, Shelter Island, Southold, and Riverhead, have an existing 2% real estate transfer tax where the money goes into a dedicated fund for the environment, for land preservation, and for water quality protection, to protect land and water. And it's been very successful. It's been in existence for about 20 years. 10,000 acres of land have been protected for farmland and open space and historic preservation. So that's an existing program. What my proposal would be to add 0.5% to that transfer tax to make it 2.5% and put that funding into a separate dedicated fund for affordable housing. And at the same time, we have an exemption from the existing real estate transfer tax. You don't pay on the first $250,000. We would increase that amount, that exemption, to $400,000. So the impact of that is that through that increase in the real estate transfer tax, overall, we would provide about $20 million for affordable housing projects on the East End. But at the same time, with the increase in the exemption, we would reduce closing costs for anybody buying a house that's under $1 million. So, you know, at both ends here, we're trying to reduce costs for housing and at the same time provide a revenue source for helping first-time home buyers, acquiring land for affordable housing projects, whether they be for home ownership or rental. Rental housing is also in very, very short supply across Long Island, particularly on the East End.
So what does affordable housing look like on the East End?
Well, affordable housing, you know, currently, I mean, you have virtually every town that has an affordable housing program. They are in the process of, whether it's East Hampton or Southampton, they've acquired land. They're building affordable housing projects, rental housing, you know, for home ownership. There's been some state grants that are available for that. There simply isn't enough of it. You know, the amount of affordable housing that they're able to produce through those programs is a drop in the bucket compared to what the demand is. So, you know, you have those types of housing projects. You have the towns working to provide more affordable housing through accessory apartments and existing single-family dwellings, apartments over stores and downtown areas. So, you know, I think towns are attempting to make the effort. Local governments are attempting to make the effort. It's just that the demand is so great, and without additional resources, without additional tools, they simply, you know, it's a losing battle under the current circumstances.
What are residents telling you about your idea? Because, you know, having researched and done stories about this for quite a number of decades now, I think everyone is always in favor of affordable housing. And then you run into that NIMBY thing, because it's like affordable housing is always great in another part of the town.
Yeah. Well, you know, first of all, overall, the response to the proposal has been overwhelmingly positive. Now, first of all, you know, it involves a tax, and nobody loves a new tax or an additional tax. But, you know, part of what we're proposing to do here is that the program that I'm suggesting through state legislation would be subject to a mandatory referendum. So voters would get to decide, number one, whether or not they want to impose this tax and whether or not they want to do an affordable housing program. But we've gotten an overwhelmingly positive response to that, even though a tax is involved. And secondly, you're right. When it comes to the issue of, you know, building an affordable housing project here or there, you get kind of two reactions. One is in a NIMBY, not in my backyard, and the other is, what is the impact going to be on school taxes by bringing, you know, additional residents and middle class families with school children? So, you know, those are the kinds of sometimes the responses that you get. And I think what is good about the proposal that we're putting forth in Albany is, number one, we're looking to make the existing housing stock more affordable by providing financial assistance to first-time homebuyers to buy any home in the community, not just set-asides for affordable housing. We're also proposing, as part of the fund, you know, payments could be made to local school districts to offset the impacts that may come from affordable housing. So I think that primarily by looking at, you know, scattered sites and financial assistance to first-time homebuyers, looking at existing housing stock, being able to mitigate the impacts as far as the impacts on schools, you know, to some degree, you know, that not in my backyard that you sometimes get with affordable housing can be mitigated. So, you know, it is a broad-based program. You know, I think it, you know, it recognizes that we can't build our way out of the affordable housing crisis by just building more housing. If that was the case, you know, we could have resolved this crisis a long time ago.
Sure.
But the marketplace really, you know, there's an advantage for seasonal homes, for second homes. We have to level the playing field so that people that want to live year-round in the community really can compete. And that's really what this fund is all about.
Assemblyman, we have about a minute left in this segment. Are you planning or hoping that this becomes a model for statewide?
I think that's the idea. You know, when we did do the Community Preservation Fund on the east end of Long Island 20 years ago with the original 2% real estate transfer tax, we did it on the five east end towns. It was such a success that now there are literally dozens of community preservation funds across the state of New York, largely in the Hudson Valley. You know, I think that, you know, often on the east end, we will be the pilot program for new ideas. I think if this can succeed on the east end, that you would see this duplicated and copied, you know, and maybe in other parts of Long Island and maybe across the state of New York.
State Assemblyman Fred Thiel of Sag Harbor, just before you go, where does it stand now? I know it's in front of the legislature and you're anticipating that they'll vote on it this session?
Yeah, that's the goal. You know, we've introduced the bill. State Senator Ken LaValle has introduced the bill in the Senate. It's in the local governments committee, which I chair. At the moment, we are busy trying to get a budget done by April 1st. But once the budget is over, it's my hope that we will act upon this bill in the second part of the legislative session in the months of May and June.
Assemblyman Fred Thiel of Sag Harbor. Assemblyman, thank you, sir. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. Look forward to talking to you again soon.
Let's bring in two more guests right now. Gail Baldwin lives out on the island, lives on Long Island. She lives in a home park in Riverside. Gail, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Thanks for being with us. We're going to bring in Ian Wilder in just a second, but I just want to start with you, Gail, for just a moment here, and then we'll let the conversation roam around for the next 15 minutes or so. Is it fair to say that you live in a mobile home?
I live in a manufactured home.
In a manufactured home. And you're retired, right?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Why do you live in a manufactured home?
Well, we had our own home in another part of Long Island, and we had a large piece of property. And looking down the road, it was not going to be possible as you age to really be able to take care of it. So we looked at the idea of a manufactured home in a community park where you would have people in your same age group over 55 with a smaller piece of property and affordable. And that was our reason for selling our house and moving here.
And how long have you been there now?
It'll be 19 years in May.
So obviously you've enjoyed it.
Yes,
you haven't moved, right? Are you hoping to stay there now?
I don't know if that down the road is going to be possible because rent increases are outdoing what we take in on Social Security. And at some point, if they keep going up and your Social Security stays where it is, it then becomes unaffordable.
I'm sorry.
That's the problem we have here.
The phone cut out just a little bit at the beginning of what you were saying. You were saying basically the cost of living there is just going up too much?
Yes. The rent increases go up every single year 4%. But if you don't get a raise in your Social Security, which for some years we didn't get, even when we got a raise this year at 2.8, our rent went up 4%. So you're always behind no matter what happens.
If you don't get enough money to continue living there, what are you going to do? Where are you going to go?
Well, that's the problem that we're all facing, and that's the reason why we're involved in what we're involved in, with trying to get some sort of a law passed in the state that, you know, prevents unjustifiable rent increases because it's putting seniors out of their homes. Some seniors are either selling if they're fortunate enough to sell. Some of them have to just walk away from their homes because there's nothing else they can do.
Are they moving to other states? I mentioned before that so many people nowadays say, you know what, this area is too expensive. I'm going to North Carolina. I'm going down south. I'm going to Florida. I'm just getting out of here.
So they're going wherever it is that they're able to go and still be able to live on what they get every month.
Ian Wilder is going to join us in just one moment. I just want to ask you, Gail, do you feel... You grew up in this area, right?
Well, actually, I was born in Brooklyn, but I grew up the second part of my years in Farmingdale.
Well, look, Brooklyn, The island, pretty much the same thing. It's all part of the island.
I've always been a New York girl.
There you go. And that's all you have to say. And I understand that completely. But with that in mind, you know, here it is. You're a senior. You're retired. And you worked hard all your life. Do you feel angry now? Do you feel betrayed?
I don't think anger is the right word. I feel disappointed, but yet I feel challenged that it's unjust what's happening and something needs to be done. So I think that's what propels me, the need to change this, because in just our situation, my total Social Security check pays the rent here.
Mm.
That's a lot.
We have
another resident in the park. 89% of her income goes to her rent.
89%. That doesn't leave much else for food or anything else.
No, she has about $115 left at the end of the month.
We had, over the holidays, just as an aside, we did a fair number of programs with the nice people who run and volunteer at food banks in the region. And they were saying that in many cases, seniors, those on fixed incomes who are retired, they come into the food banks. And the people who run these food banks were telling us, you'd be surprised at the amount of people who come in.
Yes, I believe that's very true because I see it in my park where I live. My church has a food bank.
Ah, your church does. Okay, Ian Wilder is joining us. He's been very nice. He's been very patient waiting on the line. Executive Director of Long Island Fair Housing Services. Ian, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for being so patient and waiting. I appreciate it. You heard what Gail's been saying. I guess this comes as no surprise to you, right?
No. We have a complete lack of truly affordable housing on Long Island. And we're hurting in so many ways. And all the crises that have hit, like Sandy and the ongoing mortgage crisis, have just made it worse.
So if you're listening to Gail and you have lots of experience in this, what is someone like Gail supposed to do? I mean, what options are available?
I don't have a lot of good answers for that, unfortunately. And in terms of, we do have a tenants' rights line that people call regularly, and they keep updated on resources. And like Gail was pretty much saying, people have to end up supplementing the income that they get with either government services that are available to help with the utilities or with food, or private places like church food banks. And at the moment, there isn't another solution. As far as I know, the rent control laws don't touch Suffolk at all, and they only touch a couple of small villages in Nassau County. I did express in a recent newspaper article, I do support the idea of the law. I did have a concern that they need to build into any law that does rent control for manufactured home parks,
right,
to protect the parks from being sold off immediately because the owner feels that would be more financially viable than whatever caps are. And we've had that recently happen with two parks, one in Amityville, one in Syosset, and the people who own the manufactured homes. There is no place to move a large number of manufactured homes in Long Island. If your park is sold, that's a problem. You have an investment, and you don't have a good place to easily move it.
And as Gail was saying just a few minutes ago, she said some of those living there get so desperate, they just walk away because they have no other option.
Yeah. I mean, it happens. It happens with the people in foreclosure, too, that they sometimes just walk away because they feel they have no other option.
Okay, so with your experience, what needs to be done to help the affordable housing situation on Long Island? That's a simple question for a four-hour answer, right?
Yeah. I mean, I can tell you some things that are being done. There was passed what's called the Long Island Workforce Housing Act, which unfortunately hasn't worked that well. There are groups of people coming together with stakeholders from all sides to try and redraft it to make it work better. What we need is we need the ability to build affordable housing throughout the Long Island. And as someone from a fair housing organization, it needs to be able to go into every area. People need to be able to choose where they want to live. It can't just be concentrated in what we call low opportunity areas. People need to be able to choose which part of a town they want to live in. Everybody has, you know, all the island has to do their fair share. You know, some people have suggested that, like other states, maybe we need a place to appeal on the state level in order for reasonable zoning changes to be made to put housing in so that people in a neighborhood can't keep affordable housing out of their neighborhood, especially if they haven't built any in their neighborhood for people to live in. It's not an easy solution. I mean, I heard that you had Assemblyman Theo on. Unfortunately, I didn't get to hear most of what he was saying, but, you know, our legislature has been trying to work on this. I don't say that I have a magic answer, but we do need to put together some type of realistic program where every area does their fair share and that there are reasonable amounts for the rent, because often what looks like affordable housing or is labeled affordable housing, the rents are often beyond the income levels of a lot of people.
Right, right. Depending on the area, right? Affordable housing can be sky high.
Yes. I mean, there are clever things being done now with land banks and land trusts in order to take out the value of the land from the property, which brings down the cost of the housing. We need more creative ideas like those.
That is creative. Gail, I'd like to bring you back in, Gail Baldwin, to just touch on something that Ian just spoke about. Because as I was saying with the Assemblyman at the beginning of the program, affordable housing is something that almost everyone says, yes, we need that. We need proper mixes in our communities. It's good for business. It's good for seniors. It's good for kids. But then when the affordable housing is proposed for certain areas, a whole bunch of people will throw up their arms and say, it's good for another area, not on my block. Do you run into that NIMBY problem?
I guess I'm not really that familiar with that because I am in a senior citizen community. So we're kind of contained here. I know that it's going on in my area, but remember, I live in the Riverside area, which is already economically depressed.
Mm.
Yes.
You know, we're trying to build up this area so that we can have more businesses come in, better housing, and just a better quality of life for anybody who wants to live here.
Well, Ian, I know some sociologists always say, you know, you have to take care of certain people in our communities. We had a business roundtable here about a month ago. One of the most important things that the business leaders said that needed to be done was that there had to be affordable housing. They were having trouble getting workers who could simply get to their job without an hour and a half commute because there was nothing that they could afford around where they worked.
Yeah, I mean, there's a problem. I live in Riverhead, by the way, so I'm very familiar with Riverside. And like Gail said, Riverside has done more than their fair share in welcoming in affordable housing. There was a development that went going up in Speonk, and I spoke at the hearing, and they were concerned that, you know, if you put one affordable housing development there, that the town was going to site them all there. And I spoke up and said, you know, if it goes in Speonk, it has to also go in every other area of the town. And I think that the business people who are saying this need to be questioning in their own local zip codes where their homes are, why isn't it in my zip code? Because it can't just be this idea of affordable housing somewhere else. Because the somewhere else is always us.
Right.
It has to be us. And yeah, I mean, it's a problem. It's a problem for anybody who has difficulty with income. Long Island is very expensive, as everybody has said, on and on. So, you know, it's a problem for keeping students here. It's a problem for seniors on fixed income. It's a problem with anybody who's on any type of fixed income. They could be a veteran. They could be someone with disabilities. So it does create difficulties. My agency is constantly, with the little resources we have for it, trying to at least point people in the right direction. But the business people believe that. I hope they come on board and start advocating in their own communities, because that's the only way we're going to get it. I mean, the other problem, obviously, on Long Island is getting land and the high cost of land.
Right.
And, you know, if there's a belief in the business community that needs to be done, then maybe they need to start talking to these land banks and land trusts to help them acquire land, including possibly putting more political pressure on, like, the county when they take back properties, that they aren't necessarily sold off, but they're turned over into affordable housing.
It's an interesting perspective. So you're basically saying that the business community, the business leaders need to take hold of this and be more proactive if they want the workers around here? Come up with some ideas, some solutions.
And the thing is, I mean, when business people speak, politicians like to say that they're always supporting business, you know? So if the business leaders are coming out, you know, maybe they need to start a group, Business Leaders for Affordable Housing. And the other thing is, let's call it what it is. It's affordable housing. You know, we don't need a bunch of different names for it. That just creates confusion and difficulty and makes it hard to talk about what it is. We need housing that's affordable. I think it would be helpful if they came together. You know, if the chambers put out statements, if they came out to the hearings at their towns, you know, they have a lot of positive public image as, you know, job creators in the community. We need to use some of the credibility and positive image that they have in order to push this forward. You know, I'll be honest, you know, who is somebody want to hear more from? A nonprofit saying we need affordable housing or the local business owner?
Hmm. Good point. Gail, what are the odds that you're going to be able to stay here, that you're going to be staying in our region and not have to go elsewhere?
That's a hard thing to say. I guess it's going to depend on a couple of factors. And you have to bear in mind, when you have a husband and wife, there's two Social Security checks that come in. When one spouse passes, you're down to the higher of the two Social Security checks. So realistically, if something happened to my husband and I lost my Social Security check, I don't really think I would be able to stay here on my income. Because if it continues to go up at 4% every year, my rent now, comes May 1st, is going to be $1,044 and change. And I get limited services for that money. I don't know how sustainable it's going to be going forward.
Do you lose sleep over this? Are you worried about the future?
No, I don't worry about it because I live one day at a time. No one knows what's going to happen tomorrow, but I'm realistic to know that my daughter moved out of New York and had to move to North Carolina, funny that you mentioned that, because they couldn't afford to stay here anymore. I don't know that that would be what I would want to do, but you know what, if you have no choice and you have to live, then you have to go where you can afford to live. So, like I said, I'm not worrying. I'm trying to be an advocate. We're praying that this bill will go through this year in Albany, that we're not asking park owners not to make a profit. That this is a business. We understand that. But what we're asking them for is not to raise the rent to a point that exceeds what we even get on an increase for Social Security. You know, be realistic.
Mm.
You know, raise the increase based on what people have so that you don't have seniors that have to give up their cars. You don't have seniors that have to forego taking certain medications, skip doctor visits, and do certain things because they simply can't afford to go.
Let me bring in Richard Cho, who's the Chief Executive Officer of the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. Richard, thanks for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, Ron.
You've been advising Governor Lamont on issues of housing and homelessness. Is the situation in Connecticut over the last few years, has it gotten better or has it gotten worse in terms of affordable housing?
I mean, I would say that the situation's gotten worse. You know, the state of Connecticut has made a lot of progress over the last few years in investing in affordable housing. We've certainly made progress in reducing homelessness, but we're still fighting upstream against the housing affordability crunch. Connecticut, the National Low Income Housing Coalition has calculated that Connecticut has the ninth highest, what is known as the housing wage. In other words, how much do people have to earn per hour in order to at working at a 40-hour week in order to afford a two-bedroom apartment on the private market. And they found that it's almost $25 an hour in working at 40 hours a week. Or at the minimum wage, a family would have to work 99 hours per week in order to afford a two-bedroom apartment on the private market. So, we're making a lot of progress with our public policies and our investments, but we're fighting upstream against a housing market that is out of control and that is really difficult for people to find an apartment on.
Those are scary numbers, and it's horrible for anybody in that situation. And I don't know if you were able to hear, but we had a business roundtable here a short time ago, and the business leaders are frankly incredibly worried because they can't get the workers that they need to live anywhere close to where the company is headquartered. And if the workers are an hour and a half away and fighting the horrible traffic around here, they're saying, what's the point?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we live in a state here in Connecticut where, the prevailing paradigm is single family homes. And what we're seeing is that in order for our economy to keep up, we really need to keep up with the kind of housing that's needed. And that's much more rental housing than we're currently developing across our state. And we need that not only in the cities, but in some of the inner ring suburbs and in other parts of the state. And so, I think we need a kind of all hands on deck approach where we're not only building housing at all different levels of affordability, but also creating subsidies that enable some of the lowest income people to access housing in the private market as well.
Richard, also on the phone with us is Ian Wilder. Ian is the executive director of the Long Island Fair Housing Services. And this is a question for both of you, if you don't mind. Are there any unique proposals, any unique ideas that we don't know about that you think should be at least studied, implemented, something that will take us out of what we've been doing over the last number of decades to look at it in a completely different vein? And Ian, I'd like to start with you.
That's a good question. I think the idea of the Long Island Workforce Housing Act was a good idea in order to put a structure above the town level in order to set some standards for what's expected in terms of affordable housing. The current structure is obviously not working, so I think we do need something else besides that. So I think that would be a good place to start.
Richard, what do you think? Anything new out there that we should be looking at?
Well, interesting. I don't even know that the best ideas are necessarily new, but there are certainly ideas that haven't really seen the light of day that in a way that they deserve. A few years ago, the Bipartisan Policy Commission, a bipartisan group of policymakers, commissioned a Bipartisan Housing Commission report. And in it, they came up with a pretty broad blueprint for how America is going to solve its housing crisis, not just affordable housing, but housing overall. One of the, I think, most compelling proposals that they had was that for every family who's earning 30% or below of the area median income, so very, very low income, should basically get rental assistance as a right, essentially, in this country. Hmm. And that we should begin by looking at how we're using our affordable housing resources to ensure that we're targeting the most vulnerable and low-income people. That's not exactly how we're using our housing resources to date, particularly our federal housing assistance, where we know the waiting lists are really long that housing authorities maintain for Section 8 housing choice vouchers and public housing. But if you look at who's on the waiting list, I actually wonder how many of those folks are really folks that could be better off if we could help them find a higher wage. These may be working households already, and it's really about helping them move up the ladder in the workforce system, which would actually free up a lot of those resources for some of the people who currently don't have any housing at all or who are earning very, very low incomes. I think we need to really look at housing not as an isolated a policy sphere, but really how is the workforce system, how is economic development, creating career ladders for folks who maybe don't need affordable housing, which would enable us to free up affordable housing for those that really need it the most.
I'm just reading between the lines, and I guess you're talking a little bit about what Connecticut is contemplating nowadays, raising the minimum wage, getting it up to $15 an hour, which would help with housing.
I think that would certainly help somewhat, although I mentioned even at the minimum federal minimum wage, a household would have to work 99 hours a week in order to afford a two-bedroom apartment. Raising that would certainly increase that. But at the same time, a lot of the folks who are in affordable housing, public housing now, it's a hard time just even getting connected to the jobs that pay a higher wage. So there needs to be a whole, I think, rethinking about how our workforce systems and our housing systems are working to make sure that people can get the kind of jobs that they need.
I wrote down that number, that 99, before because I was calculating. I said, well, as soon as you open your eyes, if you start to work, and then if you do that 7 days a week, you'll make enough money to pay your rent.
That's right. And that doesn't take into account any other household expenses, right? It doesn't take into account food. It doesn't take into account clothing and all the other expenses.
Exactly. Gail Baldwin is still with us on the line. Richard, I don't know if you were able to catch a little bit of the conversation earlier. Gail is a resident of the Riverwoods mobile home community in Riverside on Long Island. And one of the reasons that we wanted to have her on, because we know this for a fact around here, Connecticut is getting older. And the population, the demographics, all the numbers show that the state is aging rapidly. And one of the big concerns is, will seniors be able to stay in their homes in this area or in their apartments? Or will they have to move elsewhere or move in with their kids? And Gail has been talking to us and saying she takes one day at a time, which I think is a wonderful way to live. But still, Gail, it's got to be tough hearing this conversation.
It is. It is. It's a concern, but you try to keep it in perspective and not let it overtake you.
Richard, is the problem for seniors especially acute in Connecticut?
I think it is. One of the most disturbing trends that we're looking at, it's also something that some emerging national research has been looking at, is the growing rates of homelessness among people who are age 50 or 55 and older. And these aren't folks who've been homeless for the last 10 or 15 years and they're just getting older. These are folks who are newly falling into homelessness at a time when their work life is winding down, their prospects for earning more income is decreasing, their health status may be even more complicated, and yet we're finding more seniors are falling into homelessness for the first time. And, you know, if you think about the public policy implications of that, let alone the human implications of that, we're looking at projecting to have some pretty significant costs. If people end up homeless, their health status deteriorates, and then we're going to wind up paying for that through nursing home and assisted living care, which is a much more expensive thing than being able to just invest in more affordable housing for seniors and people who are soon to become seniors. I think the aging trend of the homeless population and the new homelessness being happening among people who are seniors is a disturbing trend that should, I think, waken all of us up to really think about how we're prioritizing our resources.
Ian Wilder, who's the executive director of Long Island Fair Housing Services, are you seeing the homelessness problem increasing on the island because of the affordable housing situation?
I don't know if it's directly to that. I mean, there's a number of different pieces. I would say the affordable housing is a problem because it puts downward pressure on what's available. The other thing that we're seeing related to a lot of the discussion is we're seeing a lot of seniors who are having problems with their reverse mortgages, which could also be feeding the increase in seniors having to deal with homelessness. Mm. We have a lot of bad things happening here. But I would say the affordable housing crunch is not helping at all, because even, somebody who might be able to afford a slightly more expensive may take what they can get in terms of housing which pushes down the availability for everybody.
I just want to squeeze in one quick email before we run out of time. Elizabeth emails and writes, as someone trying to purchase a condo in Connecticut, downsizing from a house, I'm finding it very difficult because the condos are sold before the open house, usually purchased by a realtor investor, and then rented out for $1,500 to $1,800 per month, which is far from affordable on a condo being sold for $150,000. Richard, I guess you would be the one who could really comment on something like that. It's a trend that is happening across the country.
Yeah, Ron, I mean, that's a really great story to just illustrate what's happening on the housing market, that we don't have a market that's just responding to supply and demand because there's so much more to it than that. There's real estate speculation. There's people such as that who are, purchasing a condo and then renting out because they realize they can actually make more money off of that. And so the housing market's responding to some of that profit-driven motivations that are really driving up rental costs above what the vast majority of people can afford. Not to mention things like Airbnb and other uses of housing to also generate revenues for folks. It's really not responding to what the needs are. And so, I think we need to take a hard look at what's happening in the housing market and find some new creative solutions to both help the people who aren't making enough, earning enough through wages to be able to afford market housing in the private market, but also look at how we're allowing that kind of speculation to take place on the private market that's driving up rental costs. The state of Oregon recently has been proposing to adopt rent control, an idea that, has been thrown out for many, many years. But the state of Oregon, looking at the fact that they're seeing an affordability crisis, has also been looking at how do we actually control the supply side of the market and try to keep the rent costs down overall.
Gail Baldwin, with the 2 minutes that we have left, I want to give you a chance to say, I would like to see this happen over the next year because I'd like to stay in my home. What would you like to see happen?
I would like to see the bill that Assemblyman Thiel and Senator Ken LaValle have put in again for, it's at least 10 plus years. It's a little different this year, but it's asking for help from unjustifiable rent increases to try to keep it in line with either the CPI or the cost of living so keep seniors in their homes. That's what we're really striving for. Something to be fair for everybody, not just us, but for the business owner who owns the park as well. Just have some protection for us, because we have no protections. There are other parks that just raise the rents. Some parks, they give 10%. There's no one to tell them they can't do that. There's no law on the books. That's what we need, accountability. That's what we want to happen this year, and we're praying it happens.
Ian Wilder, final thoughts from you, sir?
Yeah, I have something that's related that I'd like to see happen this year. The governor's put up a source of income discrimination bill. We already have laws in Nassau, Suffolk, New York City, and Spotty around the state. And you mentioned housing choice vouchers. People with housing choice vouchers, when they actually get the voucher, often have a hard time renting because of source of income discrimination, not to mention veterans, seniors, other people. I'd like to see that pass the state this year so we have one statewide standard for source of income discrimination.
Richard Cho, you were kind enough to come on with us at almost the last moment. We appreciate it. And you get the last word, sir.
Oh, thank you. Well, I would certainly back up what Ian just said in terms of ending income source discrimination in housing. The other thing I want to do is look at how are we using our existing resources differently. There's 99,000 units of federally subsidized housing in the state of Connecticut. How can we make sure more of that is prioritizing some of the highest need households, particularly those that are experiencing homelessness? So I think some of it is just about how we're taking the resources we already have and ensuring that they're going to the folks who need it the most.
Richard Cho is the Chief Executive Officer of the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. Ian Wilder is Executive Director of Long Island Fair Housing Services. And Gail Baldwin is a resident of the Riverwoods Mobile Home Community in Riverside and the Secretary of the Mobile Manufactured Homeowners Association of Suffolk Incorporated. My thanks to all of you. I appreciate your time today, and I wish you the best of success.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And that is going to do it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Our associate producers are Christian Carter, Sabrina Garone, and Natalie Chafari. Our digital editor is Carrie Frank. Ann Lopez is our producer, and Terry Sheridan, our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to all of you for being part of The Full Story.